Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guests, Treg and Jesse Lindberg. Jesse has previously joined us to share the lessons that she has learned supporting abused women and children through her organization, Turning Point. Treg is a very successful sales executive. However, today they are not here to talk about their professional experiences and accomplishments. They've joined us today to talk about what they have learned and experienced as a family raising their 16-year-old son, Brody. Brody is one of one, not just to the Lindbergs, but to the world. He was born with a chromosomal abnormality that is unique to him. No one else on the planet is known to have it. And this abnormality has caused significant global development delays. As you will hear Jesse put it, Brody in many ways is a 16-year-old who operates cognitively at the level of maybe a 5-year-old in some areas and below in others. And the struggle that they have faced as parents, as spouses, as a family within the system that they have to operate in, the medical system, the school system, the support system, and beyond, has taught them many lessons that they share quite readily. And I'm very thankful that they chose to take the opportunity to join us today and talk about what they've learned about themselves, each other, their son, the world around them, how they see and approach it, the strength that it's given them, the love that it has engendered, and so much more. So some of the topics that we're going to talk about today include the fact that can't does not equal no opportunity. There are always ways to create opportunities. How people can communicate when we can't use words, either because they can't be spoken or they can't be understood or sometimes both. The importance of slowing down and noticing the little things, the value that those little things can have. The importance of asking the right question at the right time in the right way so whoever you're asking it to understands it and has a legitimate answer alternative. And Jesse is going to share a poem that's been very special to her called Welcome to Holland. And hopefully in sharing that poem, other people can find strength in it as well. So thank you all very much for taking the time to join us this week for a different conversation than we maybe have had traditionally on the show, but one that nonetheless is extremely important as we explore how we can all improve how we communicate, how we listen, how we interact and support those around us. So before we dive in, we'd love to take a minute to thank our sponsors. First, we have Humantel. Please head over to humantel.com and enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class online self-paced learning. For all of you that have thought, I would love to know what people are thinking and feeling in real time by checking their changes in their facial expressions and their nonverbal behavior. This is the place to go. I highly recommend it. I've done it all myself. Once you learn how to witness these changes, it's very hard to unsee them and then begin to evaluate them within the context of the situation. Humantel.com and QASIV25 is the code. I highly recommend it. For the professional interviewers, please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com so you can learn all you need to know about the International Association of Interviewers, the group and individual benefits, the online educational and support resources, the in-person training and education opportunities, what it takes to become a member, what it takes to join the board, give back to the organization. Everything you need is right there. That's where you can also learn more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify? How do you prepare and pass the exam? And then once you earn the designation, how do you maintain it? And what does it mean for your career moving forward? All those questions and more answered at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please head over to inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to facilitate to their senior leaders, sales teams, HR teams, and beyond, to teach them the ethical and persuasive observation and communication skills necessary to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences. The result is stronger relationships, unexpected outcomes, and so much more. All the details and more over at inquasive.com. We really appreciate you all checking in for today's episode. Thank you very much. Treg and Jesse were extremely generous with how open they were in the conversation, and there's so much we can all learn from it. So thank you for being here today. And now, without further ado, I introduce to you Treg and Jesse Lindberg. Good afternoon, Treg and Jesse. It is great to see you both, to have you both here at the same time. Jesse, welcome back. Treg, welcome. Here. How are you both doing today?
We're so awesome. Good. We're great.
We're happy. Good job, Treg. Let her answer for you. That's the right way to go. We're off to a flying start.
Good job, honey. It's such an honor for you to even ask us to do this. We're so grateful. Thank you.
No, I am extremely grateful. And we were joking a little bit before we got on. Well, I actually wasn't joking. This might be the conversation I've been most nervous to have in my entire professional career. But for those who maybe are listening and not watching, I'm here with Jesse and Treg Lindberg, husband and wife of an amazing son who we are about to talk about their relationship and what they've learned and what they've experienced and how to apply that to both our family lives and our business lives. Professionally, as a bit of backdrop, Jesse, you've been on before talking about your experiences with Turning Point. That was an awesome conversation. Treg is a very successful sales leader, so we have the different perspectives professionally and personally coming in. But really the purpose of the conversation today, and I'm so grateful that you both are willing to do this, is to talk about your amazing son and your amazing family and all that you have learned and experienced and overcome and taught each other throughout. So for people who aren't lucky enough to know you both, Jesse, I'll start with you because we know you're the boss. I'll ask you this. Please tell us a little bit about Brody and what he has taught you.
Little Brody, well, not so little anymore. Now he's 121 pounds. We just had him weighed. But Brody Lindberg, he is 16 years old. And he's a literally diamond in the rough, needle in the haystack, however you want to put it. He was born with a chromosomal abnormality that has never been seen before. So he is followed by a couple of institutions that really kind of monitor and follow abnormal chromosomes and kind of what those might mean for a child down the road. But he's an anomaly, and he's just a super special boy. He's got global developmental delays. So he's 16, but cognitively, he's probably about 4 or 5, I would say. And just, you know, everything that comes along with that, fine motor skills are really tough for him. He's not going to hold a pencil or a pen and write anything. And he doesn't love coloring, all those things that are really challenging for him. And he also has speech apraxia, which unfortunately for us, we were told when he got that diagnosis that it's pretty much the worst speech disorder you can have. And what it means is basically that the brain misfires when it's trying to get to the mouth and what it's trying to say. So your brain knows what it wants to say, but all of the things that, you know, go into speaking, you know, getting what's in your mind, but using your tongue, your lips, your teeth, all those things, just putting those together is virtually impossible. So he does have about 90 words or approximations of words that he says, and he's very bossy and will let you know what he thinks. So we basically communicate with him mostly through yes and no questions, and he understands pretty much everything you say to him, but he will let you know. He knows no for darn sure. He can say that very well. We hear that 1,000 times. But he's a very special boy. Yeah, he's getting to an age. He's 16, so he's a little challenging right now. We think, you know, just hormones and honestly being a 16-year-old trapped in the mind of a 4-year-old is very challenging for him. And so we're seeing some behaviors that are a little hard, but we're going to get through it. And ultimately, I would say 98% of the time he's the best boy in the world. It's just that 2% where you kind of want to pull your hair out a little bit.
I would imagine that parents all across the world could agree with that statement. Yeah. Great kid until they're not, but it's temporary.
Yep.
Brooke, being the far better parent than I am, likes to talk to Gabe about, you know, what is temporary versus what is permanent, and feelings and emotions and reactions and situations often being temporary. But you three have already gotten through so much. No doubt that you'll continue to get through more. Treg, what your little boy taught you? Your not so little boy taught you.
My not so little boy. You know, looking at it from the outside in, you know, you see the Facebook life or the Instagram life where it's all perfect and great pictures and all that. But the behind the scenes, you know, the biggest thing, you know, and I'm a person of faith, so I don't want to offend anybody, but, you know, when you pray for patience, you get a lot of opportunities to practice. We've gotten a lot of opportunities to practice. And, you know, what that's done is made me a more patient person, albeit probably not as patient as I need to be with everything going on. But, you know, that's the big thing is slowing down and realizing that he can't do certain things doesn't mean we can't give him the opportunity. So we've got to slow down. I'm a 90 mile an hour guy. I just go. You know me. So I'm high energy, high speed. And what he forces me to do is slow down and really take time and notice the little things. You know, one thing that's really unique about him is when he hits a milestone, it could be putting a two-word sentence together like, yes, please, right? That for us is massive. And noticing those little things is something that, you know, most people will gloss over. But for us, that is huge in our world. So it takes, a little bit of slowing down and a little bit of patience to realize that little piece of growth is monumental. So that's kind of one of the main things he's taught me in particular.
That's a great point. And I want to make sure we keep the focus on your family. I feel like that's a lesson that we can all learn, whether it's in our personal relationships, our professional relationship. When we're going fast, we miss things. You know, how many times, and you both know, Brooke, you know, how many times have I had an opportunity to compliment her on something or recognize something or address something? And I get in the truck and I'm a half a mile down the road. And I'm like, oh no. And that's even if I recognize it at all. Right. So being able to slow down and whether it's celebrate or address or recognize or do those things is really important. And I'm sure patience is something that you two have worked on in spades compared to many other people. And that's an incomplete journey. That's one that never ends for sure.
Yeah. Well, it's all perspective too. When you're talking, you know, our world versus everybody else, it's not, you know, oh, we're here and everybody else, everybody's got challenges. So I don't want to gloss over the fact that just everybody's challenges are different. And when you're in that moment, your challenge is the biggest amongst everybody, right? So, I mean, there's parents we know that, you know, have typically developing kids and they're going through some horrible stuff. And it's all relative based off of where you are in that moment. So, again, I don't gloss over that piece that it's not unique to just us. Everybody's got challenges. It's just how we work together, really. And rather than let it tear us apart, I think it's brought us closer together as a family.
And for me, from the outside looking in, that's been one of the most noticing things that I've seen from when the three of us first got to know each other, which for people listening was independently, by the way. I got to know you both separately. It wasn't like we were neighbors or we met simultaneously, how it all worked out. But whether it is from you guys sharing your story online, whether it's from the conversations that we've had, Treg, even go back, what is it, almost 10 years now when we started working together, having conversations at your desk and being so open and sharing about it, that it really appears, and I know there aren't perfect days and it's a roller coaster and ups and downs, but you have really looked at it as an opportunity to galvanize your family unit and work and build, as opposed to look at it as something negative or the extra weight.
You know, what's funny about that is that I remember when I first started working for the ARC, that was my first nonprofit job many years ago. And the one thing when I was on the kind of speaking circuit for the United Way, I would do these speeches about Brody. And then this for the United Way, I'd go to businesses. And this was part of their United Way campaign to get people to donate to the United Way, which the ARC was funded in a very small part by the United Way. But people would come up to me after almost every time and say, so sorry. And I'm thinking to myself, I just told you a story about my son. Did I talk about some of our challenges? Yes, but the purpose of my story was not, you should feel sorry for me. You shouldn't pity me and you shouldn't pity our family. I was trying to say that I was providing hope. There was hope because there was an agency like the ARC that was there to help us. And I always found that to be, I think people were very well-intended, but I'm actually, it's like more insulting for you to look at me and say, I feel really sorry for how awful your life is with this beautiful little child, you know? And it doesn't mean obviously we're even very much so right now with him being 16. There's a huge discrepancy between our lives with a 16-year-old and our friends that have 16-year-olds right now. 16, I'm going to be honest, was very difficult for me. I shed a lot of tears because this was a big age, right? We should be buying him a car. I should be able to go to work in the morning and say, you know, this summer and be like, bye, babe, see you later. Mommy's going to work. Can't do any of that, right? We still have to have a babysitter. We might as well have a toddler. And we do, for all intents and purposes. We have a 16-year-old toddler. And so I struggled with it. But it doesn't mean I want to be pity. It just means I think we want empathy and understanding and grace for the fact that our lives are different. They just look different. And the structure of our family is different and how we have to live and survive and work and all the things.
And at any moment in time, to Treg points too, that empathy and grace is something that we can all use. And maybe to follow up on your point about people saying, I'm sorry for you. Like, if you ever hear somebody share a really vulnerable, open, personal story and you're not sure what to say about it, just don't say anything.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Give a hug, shake a hand, say thank you, whatever is appropriate. But that way, to your point, I'm sure they were well-intentioned, but it can't be easy to hear. When you talk about this being a particularly difficult time and there's, you know, the comparison and the aspiration and the reality and all of those things that set in, to get back to points that both of you have made, it appears that a theme that you have is finding strength in the opportunity and being grateful for what you have, as opposed to looking at it from a different, less productive angle. As somebody who may or may not need additional education or perspective on marriage and happiness and health and taking care of his family, I'm just asking for a friend. How have you two learned to support each other? Because when I think about Brooke and I think overall we do a good job supporting each other, but there's times where I miss, right? So I'm sure it's not perfect, but how have you two learned to realize what you need and when you need it and how to provide it for each other?
We have an interesting balance, Trig and I. So if I'm flipping out, he's always really calm and looking at me like, babe, calm down. It's really not a big deal. And then when he's really heightened and frustrated, I'm like, oh my God, would you stop? It's not that big of a deal. And we somehow balance each other out that way. We never allow both of us to be at our wit's end. And it happens naturally. And I think it's something that you develop when you have a kid with special needs because you don't have a choice. If we somehow both lose our minds, we're all Brody hacks. And so one of us has to be keeping it together at a time. It doesn't mean we're not allowed to fall apart and cry, but it means we can't both do it at the same time. So we're pretty good at that.
Yeah. There,
right? Am I right? I don't know.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And apparently I sound like Napoleon Dynamite. That was a great impression. Thank you. But no, she's exactly right. It goes to communication, and Lord knows there's been so much that we've each learned from one another on how to communicate. But it's I struggle with. I'll tell you this is I don't like being wrong. And
really,
no, it's one of those things, right? I'm always right. Just ask me.
It's really I've never met anybody like that. I mean, I'm not kidding. You really can't be wrong.
That's it. So, but having the wherewithal to stop and realize, okay, I screwed up. That's my fault. I should have done differently, better, whatever. Being open to apologizing, which I certainly still am working on. We're married by the grace of God and her patience, but you know, it's definitely a challenge. It's work, right? But it's worth the work. It's like anything worthwhile is uphill, right? So anything that we do together is way more fulfilling than anything we do apart, right? So everything, you know, we call ourselves the Three Musketeers. We do everything together, right? We don't want to, you know, leave one out and go off and do something else. We always want to, and because it's fun when we're a family, like, you know, on Saturday, we'll do a family fun day and just the three of us will go do it, have adventures, right? And that's the super fun part for us is working together. But it's also realizing that, hey, you know what, Treg, you're wrong a lot. You better admit when you're wrong and go, hey, babe, my bad. I screwed up there. I'm sorry. You know, here's what I'm going to do next time. And thank you for your patience in pointing that out versus taking that defensive posture. What do you mean I'm wrong? You're wrong. And then you get into that 20 finger mode. And I always lose that one. So
I think it's important to point out that the divorce rate among special needs parents is really, really high, like 75 to 80%.
It's double.
And I can very easily see how that is. It's really hard. Like he says, oh, we go out and have all these fun days. Well, we did. Like Saturday, we had a great day. But was it fun when my child threw an absolute fit because we took his iPad away? And it was so embarrassing at this restaurant. And, you know, he's really strong and we can't contain him now. We're to a point where he weighs more than I do. So I can't, you know, it's very hard to even just wrangle him in. So yeah, it's real. Those are the days. Did we have the best day ever after that? Yes. But there was about a 20-minute period where we were like, oh my God, this is not cool at all. Like, do we just go home? What do we do? But no, we fight through it. We're like, yep. No, we're not going to do this. And we're not going to shelter him and not take him out because we're scared that he might throw a tantrum. We're not going to do that. We're going to go out and do it and take the risk. And sometimes it works. Sometimes it's miserable, but
we're doing it together.
Yeah.
And talking about that divorce rate, I think really is an important piece. And I'm going to knock on wood, by the way, because I'm superstitious. So let's just get that out of the way. But that's a very important piece because I'm imagining from the outside looking in, there is no off time. There is no reset button. There is no, you know, tomorrow this will be over, or I'll get to rest, or I'll get to recuperate. It is 100% of the time, no break. And when you think about the stress that would put on any relationship, let alone a marriage, that's real for sure. Have either of you developed techniques to help you kind of manage the stress level that comes along with the constant responsibility, either separately or together?
No, we just do it. I mean, I do. I just do what I have to do. And yeah. I think I always live with the mindset that we are all this child has. We are all we have. And so we're like the spokes on a wheel. And if one pops off, we're in really big trouble. So I think just instinctively, we don't let one of those spokes pop off because we know it would be catastrophic for our family. That's
I'm
what
not
I mean.
That good. I need as much help as I can get. So, there's, you know, obviously I had mentioned a person of faith. So there's a lot of prayer that goes in, you know, self-reflection, meditation. I read a lot, you know, trying to just self-reflect. So I get up early in the morning. I spend some quiet time with myself to really reset my brain on what's the overall, what's the big picture here? Okay, so my kid threw a tantrum in a restaurant. Big deal. Okay, did anybody, you know, I mean, what are we talking about? He knocked over a glass. Whoop-de-doo. Doesn't matter. You know, but having that reset, it takes me a minute to do that. And then when all else fails, you know, there's bourbon, right? So there's.
Well, and we have an incredible support system. We've got the greatest group of friends.
That's right.
That love our child like their own. It's a small but mighty group that I would count in that group that we literally consider family. But they love our child and they have a lot of understanding and grace and empathy for us. And so they make it a little easier. I think we both love exercising. I love working out has been my therapy for sure. If I don't get to do that, that's what rights my mind in the morning, not just because I have a kid with special needs, but because I also have a really stressful job. And so I think that's one of the things, but I think our support system is a big deal. My parents are close by. Thank goodness for them, but thank goodness for our friends. They're really supportive and they love us a lot.
Well, then I think those are two big keys, you know, outside of the strength that you draw from each other, actually probably three big keys outside of the strength that you draw from each other, having the support system there. So whether it's there for, and this goes even for most people outside of this particular circumstance, whether it's there for you or you go create it, having a support system, having some sort of outlet, whether it's, you know, exercise, which, you know, there's all kinds of health reasons why that's good for your brain, but whatever it is, creating that outlet for you, you know, trag, bourbon, responsibly, moderation, you know, all of those things. But you mentioned your faith too, and you mentioned reading and finding that, whether that sense of calm, that centering, that something to reflect back on, those guideposts that we all put in our lives they're important for all of us, but they're likely even more important for you both. And one of the things that I feel like I'm hearing throughout all of this is prioritizing the I'm going to say this in a way that is so minimizing the significance of it, but prioritizing the long-term goals and outcomes and most meaningful things in as many situations as possible to provide perspective. So right now, you know, metaphorically speaking, right now, this sucks, but we're all we have. So we're going to get through this together. We're going to find a way. We don't have a choice. It's amazing of what you're capable of when you don't have a choice. So we're going to find a way to work through this. And not getting, I'm sure it happens from time to time, of course, but generally working hard not to get caught up in the moments by keeping your eye on what is most important and what you're working towards in those scenarios.
And we also try not to think, you can't let your mind go to, you know, and we do say it sometimes, but it's very difficult to face what we will, what our lives will be like long-term.
Sure.
Like we know we're never going to be empty nesters, you know, that type of thing. We know we're never going to watch our child get married. We know we're never going to have a grandchild. You know, that stuff's hard. And so some days, if you let yourself go down that rabbit hole, it's very difficult to climb back out. So you let yourself think about it, but you're like, ooh, no, don't do that. Don't let your mind go there because it can be it's very difficult. And that's just the reality of it. And I think, you know, I reflect back always. One of the most life-changing things that ever happened to me since I became Brody's mother was discovering this poem called, it's going to be very challenging to get through this. Okay. There's a poem called Welcome to Holland, and it was written by the mother of a son with Down syndrome who was born in the 80s. And even in the 80s, people were telling doctors and hospitals were telling parents of kids with special needs to put your child in an institution and tell your friends that your child died in childbirth and just pretend basically like they were never born. And she goes on to compare that grief, because you do go through those stages of grief. And I feel like we go through the stages of grief every time we hit a milestone that isn't happening. You start all over again. But she compares that grief to getting on a plane and thinking that you're going to Italy, and you're thinking about all the things that you're going to see in Italy. And when you land, the pilot says, "Welcome to Holland." And you're like, "What, Holland? I don't want to go to Holland. I wanted to go to Italy. I wanted to see the Colosseum, all these things." But then you look at Holland, you get there, and you realize that Holland has tulips and windmills and all the beautiful things about Holland. And it makes you reflect back on how blessed you really are and how this is by design, a design that's far beyond anything that I could understand. It was a design that was handed to me by something far greater than me. And at some point you embrace it and you see the beauty of Holland instead of mourning your trip to Italy. And it was really life-changing for me to read that, because in the very beginning when Bede was born, I really struggled. I loved him. I didn't have postpartum depression. I didn't not want to be around him. It wasn't that. I just was in mourning. I was in mourning for the life I thought I was going to have. And it took a little while to get out of it, but then you have no choice. And then all of a sudden you start seeing the beauty in this little person who has every challenge in the world thrown at him, but he's such a little love and he's so funny and loving and happy. And the geneticist, the last time we saw him, he said, "I don't know what to tell you. He's a very well-adjusted little boy and he knows he's loved. And I can't tell you what to think. I don't know what to think about his future. I don't know what his future holds, but I would tell any parent that. So just keep doing what you're doing. Make sure your little boy knows you love him. And that's all I can tell you." And so that's what we've been doing ever since.
Thank you. And again, it's probably true for most families, right? Just make sure that your children know that you love them and that you're there for them. And that that line, "we're all we have," like just they know that. And I'm sure that, Trey, you have lots of pictures that don't get posted. But the ones you do post, he's always smiling. And he's got this big beaming smile in every single one of those. And from the outside looking in, that is the smile of somebody who knows exactly what it means to be happy and who makes him happy and what makes him happy and how to be happy. And there's huge compliments in there for both of you for the systems you've put in place and for the love that you provide and for everything that you've gone through. Treg, I'd love to ask you, you mentioned earlier a milestone could be putting a two-word sentence together. So communication has been a challenge, no doubt, throughout the entirety of your relationship with Brody. Early on, how did you first learn to, and I guess as parents, we all sort of do it subconsciously, right? With it, with any infant, but how did you learn to really dial in to what Brody was thinking, feeling, needing by observing him?
Yeah. And that's, you know, that goes back to me having to slow down to actually pay attention. But that's really what it boils down to is watching those successive approximations to something and realizing what he's saying. And even now, you know, there's still times where he's trying to tell us something, or especially me, and I don't know what he's saying. And it's he knows what he's saying. And so I'm just like, show me, bro. What, buddy, show me, bring me there. What are you trying to tell me? And that's the hardest thing as a parent. If you can't understand what he's trying to tell you, then the frustration can build and behave, you know, so that's a constant challenge for us. But back to your question, when did I initially figure that out? It is an innate thing as a parent, right? I mean, I don't know how to actually describe it. It was more along the lines of, all right, well, what's he doing? Okay, I think he's hungry. Okay, this means that, you know, and just watching his movements and asking questions to find out what it is he wants. Do you want this? Yes or no? Do you want this? Yes or no? Do you want this? Yes or no? And eventually we got to what he's looking for. But it was getting, when he was able to answer yes or no questions, it really changed our life, because now we can, you know, you're talking about discipline listening, and it's also about question asking and things like that. It's asking the right question to get the answer that he's trying to give us. And so it's really helped communicate with him in a way that he can understand. So it's changing our communication style to him, not having him try to change it for us. So that was the initial challenge, but just observing him and asking the right question.
And I imagine a lot of that also involves like situational awareness. So depending on what time of day it was, depending on where you were, depending on things that just happened or normally would happen and those kinds of things. And for lack of a better phrase, doing the math and making educated guesses on this is likely what I need to do to support him right now.
That's right. Yeah. And it's just like real world conversations, right? With anybody, you have to look at the context and what you're talking about in the situation you're in and what the mood is, right? So if he's, you know, maybe just getting out of bed and I've been up for 3 hours, you know, I'm already 3 cups of coffee in, I'm going. He's just waking up, right? He's not at my speed yet, right? So knowing that he's just getting up, okay, well, let's slow it down a little bit. Now, maybe in the middle of the day, he's ready to go and I need another cup of coffee or something, right? But it's reading that situation, just like you said, and having that situational awareness and realizing all of the surroundings, you know, what is actually going on. Is there a noise in the background that may be like a bird chirping that, you know, most people just ignore, but that may be something that triggered him, you know, because that's one of the things we found out. We're out to eat outside and a bird starts chirping and, you know, sensory-wise, it didn't quite jive with him. So he starts, you know, kind of getting frustrated and we're like, what's going on? And, you know, again, slowing down, realizing what's out there that most people don't pay attention to. We had to figure that out and it was trial and error.
And they come out of nowhere. Birds chirping came out of absolutely nowhere. Seagulls at the beach. I'm like, my one happy place. Now seagulls are bothering you. Oh no, it was terrible. Little kids, little tiny kids only in restaurants. He gets annoyed by now. These are all new and they'll come and go. And so we'll look at each other and be like, oh, now this is a sensory, like, where did this come from? He's a handful. But you know, I think there's also an inherent, like, you just know that you have a very vulnerable child. And so you just, it's just kind of like anybody with a baby, you know, just how I'm sure you were with Gabe when they're little, you're just so in tune to it because they can't tell you. And so you just, as their parent, are so in tune to what they need because you know they can't tell you. And if you, who else is going to feed them? You know what I mean? And we say that to each other all the time some days. I'll be like, look at him. I just hand him something and he doesn't even look at it. He just takes it and eats it because he's so trusting. But if we weren't there, this child literally would not eat, wouldn't have anything to drink, wouldn't be able to go potty. None of that without help. And it's terrifying. That vulnerability is absolutely terrifying as a parent, especially given what I do for a living and knowing that this special needs population is specifically and particularly vulnerable to abuse and neglect. And I think it's a conversation that doesn't happen enough. We talk a lot about marginalized people, but yet somehow people with developmental disabilities don't ever really make it into that conversation very often. And they are actually statistically the most vulnerable population, more prone to abuse, more prone to neglect than any other population. But they are so underserved. And if anybody needs to know about the state of North Carolina and how it treats its people, I won't get on the soapbox for long. There's a 10 to 12 year waiting list for services through the state for kids with special needs. So when a kid turns 22 and he's out of school, if those parents didn't put that child on that waiting list 12 years ago, they have to quit their job because this kid can't go anywhere. You know what I mean? They're not in school anymore until they get on this waiver that allows them to get help with people helping in the house or taking them to day programs or whatever it looks like. So they're also an extremely underserved population. And it's honestly shameful. It's a sad thing. And I have a friend who just had to quit her job because her daughter's been on that wait list for so long. And she was done with school and now she's home with her. So that's probably a conversation for another day because I could do another hour just about that. But
well, maybe we should. Another hour on that.
Yeah.
It is tragic. And when you stop and think about it, or I guess now I'm forced to stop and think about it would be a better way to say it. When we think about people like this, they literally don't have a voice. So, and the people who they rely on for a voice are the ones who are abusing them. Like, of course there's no cavalry coming. There's no help coming. So yeah, it's pretty awful. And I think you both know that early in my career, I worked in special education for a little while, which is like a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the experience you have as parents. So I want to make that distinction very clear. But even being able to see often, regardless of what the children were battling, it was the quality of the family unit at home that made the difference in their social adjustment, their education, their achievement, what they were capable of, could do, their growth, all of those things. The children who had stronger family units at home typically fared much better than the ones that didn't. And unfortunately, to your point, several that came from divorced homes were facing additional challenges because any child is going to go through the emotional roller coaster of trying to deal with that. So now add that on top of everything they're already dealing with, and it's an extra layer of challenges. You mentioned, you know, the vulnerability, Jesse, and just caring for and looking out for our children. I used to joke with Brooke, but it wasn't really a joke, that especially when Gabe was like a baby, I was worried about getting arrested at Harris Teeter because someone would reach into the cart just to like be like, oh, he's cute. And the next thing you know, someone's waking me up and saying, what did you do that to that person for?
That's my baby.
Yeah. So I definitely mean mug innocent people in the grocery store for no reason at all when Gabe was a baby. But we know I have my own personality issues to deal with. Legitimate question that finally leads me back, and I'll start with you, Jesse, is especially being mama bear in this situation, is I'm sure that both of you were more, and every new parent is in tune to those who are around their children, but I'm sure more so for you when it came to doctors, caretakers, therapists, teachers, these people who were around Brody. How quickly did you feel like you dialed in your evaluation skills to understand who you can trust, who you were concerned with, and who you needed to separate Brody from?
Oh, man, that's a good question. And I'm going to tell you, I figured it out. And what's even cooler is Brody figured it out when he was really little. So you can tell. So when you have a child with special needs, you can tell a very distinct difference between the people that are like, oh, yeah, hey, and the people who are actually like, hey, buddy, like today, I'll give you a perfect example. I dropped our dog off to get groomed. He was so excited about it. He thought it was so funny and great. And this lady had just dropped her dogs off and I couldn't get B to leave the groomer. He was too excited. And she had her leashes. She's like, come on, can you help? Come on, buddy. Can you help me put these in my car? Like she instantly stepped in to help and put her hand out and was like, come on, bud, help me. And he instantly turned. Like this lady out of absolutely nowhere did that today. That's who I learned to trust. But you can instinctively and immediately tell if it's not genuine. But more importantly, Brody can tell if somebody is genuinely nice because they care about him and they want to be around him, or if they're just being like tolerant of him. But it's just, I can tell instantly. I can tell in the way they make eye contact. I can tell in the way that their physical body is in comparison to him. I can tell if he likes, you know, he does this when he gets excited. Is that going to throw somebody off, or are they going to lean into it and really see that he's excited? And he's just, that's his way. That's his body's way of like manifesting that excitement. But you can just, yeah, I can instantly tell. But he's funny, because if he doesn't like it, if Brody Lindbergh doesn't like you, you have no hope and you clearly have no soul. Because my child is a very good judge of character, but I think I now get it from him. I watch his body language.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But you can just tell. You can tell when people are disingenuous.
Yeah. I wonder if, and here I am openly speculating about something you just shared about your child, so I apologize in advance. But if that's like, you know how some people don't have certain senses, so their other senses are heightened. Like maybe if I can't see, my smell is much better. If I can't smell, like my taste, whatever. I wonder with Brody if like that's a learned sense, a learned behavior, a learned way to evaluate the world around him based on who he is. That would make sense.
100%. And I think like we've almost inherited that from him. So those instincts that he has, I feel like we've gotten them now from him because he is. I think kids that have sensory issues, I think most kids with speech disorders typically have sensory issues because it's just something about that, you know, not being able to speak that makes you more sensitive and worried and fearful of what's going on around you. So, yeah. But I agree. I think for sure, wherever you have deficits, you have other senses that make up for it and are super heightened.
I think it's fantastic, too, that both of you have learned and picked up on that from him. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jesse, great for you, but Trey, for a guy who's always right, congratulations on learning from your son. I got to try to work in a joke here or two somewhere, right? Can't have it 100% serious. But like, that says a lot. Like instead of being, you know, I'm the parent, I'm in control, I'm the one who's making the decisions, I need to be the one who knows what's going on all the time and in charge all the time, like deferring to him. And there's times where he is the one who really is in the lead and that we're taking it, in a lot of ways, advice and instruction from him, maybe not in the traditional sense, but we're seeing how he learns and adapts and controls his environment and reacts to his environment. And because of that, we can do it too. And we can learn and improve from that.
Oh, and listen, all that goes out the window, whatever nature and society and whatever, all of that is normal, right? That's usually what dictates how somebody's life progresses. All of those rules are out the window for us. So we're like flying by the seat of our pants all the time. But it does mean that, yeah, Brody's running the show because I can't rely on, oh, well, he's 15 now, he should be doing this. We don't have that luxury. So it is, he dictates everything because the things that I think parents instinctively rely on to tell them what should be happening with their children and what they should be doing for their children, you know, we don't have that. So we have to let Brody guide us.
Treg, I'd like to kick this back to you for a second. Jesse, I'll come back to you, I promise. One of the things that even just for me as a parent, and we only have the one son, that we were told because he was entering school age and different things is the need to be an advocate for your child, regardless of what somebody else is saying or telling you in their position. And I can only imagine that for the two of you, that's multiplied by like a factor of 1,000. where there are times where very clearly you can see Brody's not getting what he needs, or the person feels like they're listening or interpreting what he's saying or doing correctly, and you know that they're not, or maybe they're offering an alternative based on what the book says. But Jesse, as you just said, the book doesn't apply here. So we need to go outside of the book. So that long segue, Treg, comes back to you to ask, how have you learned to, for lack of a better phrase, stand up for what you know is right for Brody and your family in a way that helps get the result that you need?
So, and that's, you know, what's funny, you should have started with Jesse on that one, because for somebody that she, and back to the knowing what people's intentions are, I will say this, and I've said this 1,000 times to Jesse, she's never wrong about somebody when it comes to our child, ever. And, you know, the initial response, I'm like, well, you know, let's give the benefit of the doubt. Let's give the benefit. She's never been wrong. So leaning on her ability to smoke that out is helped us tremendously. But also navigating the system, to your question, advocating for our son. You know, my wife used to work for the ARC, and she got, and so it's just a neat path when you look at, you know, We had a plan for our family. We're going to have a big family and all this. She was going to stay at home. I was going to work. It was going to be this nuclear family kind of thing. And, you know, God saw our plan, laughed, and gave us a different plan, right? And in that, it led Jesse to working at the ARC, which is basically an organization to help families with special kids with special needs. And learning that system and navigating it is so freaking difficult that unless you have somebody helping you through that, you don't know what you're doing and you're lost. And you're trying to figure it out for yourself. And I mean, you know me, I ain't that smart. So trying to do that on my own would have been impossible. So she had the knowledge to be able to know what's right. What is actually legally obligated for the school system, the healthcare system to provide our child, and knowing what good looks like and what doesn't, what isn't good, and being able to make that adjustment. I mean, you know, we're fortunate. We've moved 4 times for our kid, right, to get him into the right school system, because we were in one area and that principal, speaking of not good people, all they wanted to do was shove all the special needs kids in a closet and hide them. And it doesn't do anybody any good to do that. But having a partner that recognized that and said, this ain't right, we got to fix it. I said, okay, well, let's move. So we just found it and we moved, right? And you know, if you ever want to learn how to buy real estate high and sell low, I'm your guy. Like, you know, we bought a house and, you know, I think we bought our second house in 07 and sold it like right after the crash. So we dive bombed on that one. But, you know, it was necessary to get our kid, because it's your child. You're going to do anything. You're going to go through a wall, over a wall, around a wall, under, whatever it takes for your child. And so having a partner that said, hey, this is what needs to happen, and then working together to execute on that plan was critical for us. So we moved to a different school district. Okay, that was great. Well, now he's out of elementary school going to middle school. Well, that middle school has got bullying problems. I'm not sending my kid that can't talk about, you know, in going to a middle school where there's bullying. So we moved, you know, and just trying to navigate what's right and where we can go to be able to put him in the right spot. But having, you know, somebody that knows the system, I'd be lost. I mean, I am lost. Let me just go there. You know, we try to share in the workload. You know, I do my 2%. She does 98%. So I see that's fair and balanced, right?
You do like 4%.
4%. So whatever.
Don't sell yourself short.
Speaking of humor, you have to have a good time, right? I mean, if we were just serious all the time, we would go absolutely nuts. We have a blast. We cut up. We joke. I mean, there's funny things that B does all the time that, you know, you just have to laugh. Like, he'll knock something over, or you'll go in his room and there's, you know, pillows everywhere. And his
breakfast. Oh, God, he destroys his room.
Oh, yeah. My Lord. He's but so you just go in and you just laugh and go, well, I guess we're going to clean that up, you know, and just, rather than get frustrated, see the other side that, you know what? Okay, my kid was, you know, he's able to walk around his room and throw stuff. Okay, cool. He's able to walk around his room and throw stuff. That's perspective that some people don't have the ability to look at and say, well, my kid's in a wheelchair or I'm feeding tube. And not to discredit anybody, it's just a perspective thing, right? So that's something that we try to keep in mind. And I know I kind of went around a lot on that, but the story of being able to navigate and fight for your child is you have to know how to navigate. And it's not an easy system. Like, you know, Jesse mentioned earlier, the waiting list, there's things we don't know about because nobody tells you this stuff. When you walk out of the hospital, you know, I'm walking out with my kid going, are they really letting me do this? Are they crazy? Do they know who I am?
Like, and they had just dropped the bomb on us that morning.
Yeah, I'm not.
By the way,
yeah.
Oh, it was horrible. I wouldn't want to relive that again.
And now I got a kid with special needs. What am I supposed to do now? Like, I don't know what to do. And so, you know, that was one of those things where when Brody was really little, you know, you looked at it and you're asking, why me? Right. Why me? What did I do? Like, why do I deserve this? And then perspective again, you look at my kid who's always smiling, and he is 99.9% of the time smiling. He's the happiest, go luckiest, go longer on the planet. And you realize that and you go, well, what did I do to deserve this kid? Like, he's awesome. Like, the fact that I get to hang out with this guy and have a blast is the blessing beyond all. I mean, this is so much fun. Like, you know, when he'll go golfing with me, or we'll go to the store and, you know, I'll let him push the cart. And, you know, if you're at Costco with me, just watch your ankles. But you know what? We're going to have fun. And that's part of what we do, is we've got to build fun into what we do. Otherwise, I'd go absolutely nuts.
Jesse, I know he said I should have asked you first, so I'll circle back.
You know, and I wouldn't know what I know if I hadn't gotten that job with the ARC. And it was very, very serendipitous that even happened. I happened to go to ask about Brody, like, as of getting help. And Melinda, you know Melinda Blue, do you know Melinda Blue? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So she said to me, actually, I have a position and I'm just getting ready to post. Would you be interested in it? And that was my foray into the nonprofit world. And it was, thank goodness, through that job that I learned, you know, in this world with a kid with special needs, there, it's very complicated. And there's a lot of systems and there's a lot of services, but nobody tells you about them. Nobody offers them to you. It takes, you have to do your research, but it also just takes people who are in the know to lead you through it. So without that, I would not know what I know. And thank goodness, because it opened up so many doors for us to be able to provide for our child and advocate on his behalf and be like, oh, well, school system, I know you're not going to offer this to me, but you're legally obligated to provide this for my child. So I realize you won't proactively offer it. So I'm going to tell you that I want you to do it because I know that you have to. And I can't tell you how many times I've encountered situations like that where you have to call people out and say, no, this is what my child is entitled to. And I don't use the word entitlement lightly because that's actually one of my least favorite words and I can't stand entitled people. But when you have somebody like Brody who is so vulnerable, it is society's job to make sure that the most vulnerable people are taken care of, period. And so, you know, you have to call people out because nobody proactively offers anything. But I will say this, the community around IDD, intellectual and developmental disabilities, is a beautiful thing. And when you can find the people that are in it to help and that are living through it, that you can lean on, it's life-changing. And those people will notice the things that you notice. I love the quote. I'll mess it up, but there's a quote that says, life is full of a million miracles and special needs parents notice them all. So they do. So one of my really closest friends, her son has special needs, and she'll tell me something if Brody was at her house that he did. And she's like, I noticed that because I'm special needs. But she's like, I knew you'd get a kick out of that. Not typical parents wouldn't see that maybe. But she noticed it. And she's like, I felt like you needed to know that this is what Brody did today because she notices it. So, you know, it's an advocacy thing, but it's a word of mouth thing. Get yourselves in the right community and you will learn and you want to help each other because nobody else, no special needs parent wants to see another special needs parent struggling. So you will find your tribe and stick with it. And, you know, that's been our lifeline for sure.
I imagine in that lesson of like the school example that you gave, I know you have to do it. You might not offer it. You might not want to do it. You might be, now I'm making assumptions, right? You might be hoping that I don't know this.
No, that's it is what they hope. I know that's not right to say. Not all schools and not all school systems. I don't want to paint them all with that broad brush, but I will tell you, there are plenty of people. Brody's at a school right now that's absolutely magnificent. Other schools he went to that we moved to get him out of, absolutely horrific. It was almost, you're like, oh my gosh, is this the first special needs child you've ever met? Or a church in preschool pulling us in to say, yeah, he just requires too much work, so he can't be here. Oh yeah, that's the thing. It's one crushing blow after another. It's very hard. We just sent him to a new camp this summer, and we had gone over. I send a bio. We met with them for an hour the very first day. I'm sorry, we didn't realize he can't take himself to the bathroom, so he can't stay here. So here we are, two working parents on a Monday, and we're like, okay, well, I guess we're going to tag team it and figure it out. It's hard. It's very hard. And it's even harder when there are certain services for people with disabilities, but your son is too disabled to even participate. And we've had that come up a lot too. There's always parameters. And so Brody will always be on the lower end of that spectrum. And so even when you hear about these wonderful things coming up for kids with special needs, you read the fine print and you're like, oh, well, he has to live independently, or, you know, whatever it is. It's hard. It's very disheartening because you're like, okay, well, let's find a couple more ways that my child can be excluded. Really frustrating, but we don't dwell on it. We get over it. I jersey it up for a couple minutes, throw some F-bombs around, and I get over it.
But it's, maybe we should call this conversation F-bombs and bourbon.
That's it. There you go. Sometimes, you know what? Like we said, you know, we got to balance each other out. And I think the beautiful thing that we will be married 20 years next year. And, you know, it's all been bliss on my side. I don't know about her. But
you're saying congratulations to you and condolences to Jesse. But again, that's another conversation.
That's right. That's right. But no, it's literally when you get that curveball thrown at you, you were the only thing he has. So it's like, all right, what are we doing? All right, I'll do this. You do that. I got this. You get this. Can you do that? I got to have this. And we just work together and we work it out. We always work it out because we have to. There's just, you know, you made mention earlier, it's amazing when you have to, what you can accomplish. And this is just a testament to what can happen when you don't have a choice.
Yeah. And just listening to the conversation, your definition of I'm speaking to you both, your definition of resilience is much different than most people's definition of resilient. Your definition of patience is much different than somebody else's definition of patient. Your definition of grateful, your definition of, you know, milestones and moments and those things. And Jesse, much like we talked about Brody developing senses to maybe balance senses that he doesn't have and honing those and those becoming more powerful, I also have no doubt that you two have done the same. And whether it is your observation skills, whether it is your empathetic skills, whether it is your communication, situational awareness skills, I wouldn't doubt that your depth of love and reliance on each other and those things as well, like you've developed those skills far beyond, or those attributes far beyond most other people. And I would also be willing to bet that, of course, with your family first and foremost, but beyond, especially in both of your chosen careers, that those pay dividends for you as well, because you're able to observe, connect with, persuade, empathize with people that others wouldn't have the capability of doing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm in where I am right now. The whole purpose of this nonprofit is to care for people and to build people up. And that's a beautiful thing. And I wouldn't be able to be in any other career. I mean, this was a complete 180 for me when I came to the nonprofit world. I was in corporate America, and I honestly couldn't imagine being in a corporate job and trying to raise Brody Lindbergh. It would be very, very difficult. There's a level of just grace and understanding that inherently comes from being in the nonprofit world that, you know, how hypocritical of me as the leader of Turning Point, if I didn't go out of my way to make sure that our team here knows that family comes first, and that, you know, you have a life outside these walls. And when you're down, we're here to build you back up again, you know, and that's really, really important. And I just want to say one thing, because I feel like we do talk about the hard things, but we would need another hour to talk about all the times that my child has directly impacted another person just by his mere presence and by his spirit, where people go out of their way to do really nice things for us, complete and total strangers, when they meet Brody. I mean, I have a lot of stories. We had a guy, I'll just tell you this one, because this is kind of everything in a nutshell. When Brody was probably 5, we went to buy a new Christmas tree at Lowe's, and we were walking around, and this guy happened to come up to us, and he was talking to B and just being super friendly, and we were telling him what we were looking for. And so we found this one. It was pretty expensive. And so we were like, oh, it's a big purchase. And he said, well, listen, I get a 10% discount because I work for Lowe's. So why don't you let me go give you that? And then that way it takes some of the price off. And he said his wife had worked with special needs kids. So we get up to the counter, and he goes up there to give them his Lowe's cards. They bring the discount, and he turns around with the receipt and says, Merry Christmas. And he bought our tree. And that happens. It happens a lot. People do really nice things. We just had a firefighter buy our dinner the other night for no good reason. So it's really hard, but much like I say about Turning Point, you see the goodness in people and you see the human spirit a lot more often than not. And I would say that that's kind of what keeps us going every day. It's the shot in the arm that we need to battle through what we battle through at 3 a.m. and the times where we really want to sometimes give up. And we don't, because we see those happy moments and we see the spirit of our child and what an absolute miracle he is. And God created him specifically to be the perfect version of himself. And so it's really good stuff, even though it's hard.
That perspective is amazing. I would counter one thought. I don't think those nice things happen for no good reason. I think those nice things happen as a reward for all the amazing things that the both of you do. And those are, however you want to say it, the universe recognizes it, people recognize it, the energy is there, but those things happen as, maybe reward is probably not the right word, but as a result of all the love and all the effort and all the time and everything that you both put in. So I'm not sure that they happen for no good reason. I think they probably happen for some very good reasons. You guys have been talking for an hour, and I am super grateful for it. And there's a lot of things I'd still love to talk about, how you applied in your professional career and what other families can learn and find resources. So maybe sometime down the road, if you're open to it, we can continue the conversation. But I want to thank you both for being so open about your family and your experience, and hopefully not only other families who might be experiencing any number of challenges with their children or their family unit can find strength and techniques and opportunities, approaches from this conversation, but even people who don't can gain new perspective and new levels of empathy and understanding and find their opportunities to impact how they communicate with others. And I just appreciate how open you are. People who know me know I grew up in the Northeast and I live in the South now. So, you know, it's a good thing I married a woman from Alabama, or I probably would have been put in jail years ago. But it's like, I'll go to a meeting and right out of the gate, somebody will be like, so are you married? Do you have kids? That's like the first question they ask me. And of course, my reaction is to go, that's none of your... calm down. That's how people talk down here. But you guys are just naturally so open, and so open in a scenario that a lot of parents and families really wouldn't be. And there's so much that people can learn from that and so much that people can take from that. So thank you for sharing your story. And I know I'm going to see you both around a lot, but certainly, you know, wish continued strength and love and success and opportunities to your family. And I can't wait, you know, Treg, to read the stories that you post, and Jesse, see the stories that you share. So all the best to your family, and keep up all the success professionally that you both have. And I can't thank you both enough for being here today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for caring about our story.
Yeah. Oh. Thanks for it, man. Just you're an awesome guy to even, and I mean, it's humbling that you would even think of us in that light. So thank you for, you know, letting us share that, and just, you know, appreciate you as a friend, man. Thank you.
Pleasure's mine. Thank you both so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Treg and Jesse. That was a very powerful conversation. Thank you for being so open. Thank you for being so vulnerable and transparent. Thank you for sharing so many of the things that you've experienced as people, as spouses, as a family, within the framework that you and your son have to operate in, as far as his medical treatment, his support in the community school, and so much more. It certainly takes a lot of courage to share as much as you both do, but it's no surprise knowing how both of you are so dedicated to supporting people in the community in every way that you can, that that carries forward into how you talk about your family as well. And I can only hope that for everybody that listened today, we found new perspectives and new opportunities to advocate for the people and for the ideas that mean the most to us. Maybe have a little bit of a different perspective and patience and understanding when we see other people in our community, a little bit more empathy towards some of the challenges that other families are experiencing, and the opportunity to improve how we communicate, how we connect, and how we work with those around us. Jesse and Trey, thank you so very much. And of course, thank you to everybody that listened to that conversation. Hopefully you found it as powerful as I did. Before we go, let's make sure we thank our sponsors. One more time, HumanTel. Please enter the code INCUASIVE25 at humantel.com for 25% off their best-in-class training to begin the process of understanding what people are likely thinking and feeling by recognizing their shifting facial expressions and nonverbal behavior. Again, I've done it myself. Highly recommend it. It's over at humantel.com. For the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn all you need to know about the International Association of Interviewers. What does it take to become a member? Who qualifies? What are the resources available, the benefits available, the education and training that's available, the networking opportunities, and so much more? That is also where you'll learn all you need to know about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation, qualifications, process for earning the designation, what it can mean for your career after the fact. So please check out certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please head over to incoisive.com. One more time, that's where you will see the courses that our clients request that we facilitate for their senior leaders, sales team, HR team, and beyond to teach them how to apply the strategic and ethical observation and persuasion techniques necessary to encourage people to open up with essentially the everyday confessions that allow us to forge stronger relationships, achieve surprising outcomes, and continue to move forward every day. We thank you all for taking the time to be here. Thank you very much. Before you head out, please like the show, share the show, subscribe to the show. Let us know what you would like to hear more of. Tell your friends about it. We really do appreciate you being here every week, and we look forward to continuing to put these together for you. Thank you all again, especially Treg and Jesse. Thank you for the conversation. Take care, stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you soon. Thank you.